Appreciate you all being with us here in the Belch Room. For the record, today is Thursday, March 11th, 2008, and senators present are Senators Davis, Ellis, and Hoffman.
Tuesday.
Okay, I just read what's on the material here. Okay, it is about 1:35 in the afternoon. The game plan for today is first to take up HGR 25, supporting the right to form labor unions by Representative Harris, Senate Bill 289, Home Energy Conservation by Senator Hoffman, and then we'll go into the RCA bill, the administration's bill on non-union public employee salary and benefits, and finally Senate Bill 160, the universal health care legislation by Senator French. So let's turn to our HGR 25 folder. There is no proposed CS. This is the second hearing on this piece of legislation. It's pretty simple and straightforward. Is there any committee discussion of HGR 25? If not, the bill has a further referral to state affairs and to finance, I believe. Is that right, Dana?
I believe that's correct, yes.
State affairs and finance. Okay. Any committee discussion? If not, the chair will entertain a motion to move HGR 25.
Mr. President, excuse me.
Are you giving me a promotion?
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Davis.
I move House Joint Resolution number 25 out of committee with individual recommendation and a zero fiscal note.
Yeah, zero fiscal note. Is there any discussion of the motion? Any objection to the motion? Hearing none, thank you, Senator Davis. The bill moves on to the next committee of referral. Okay, let's turn now to Senator Hoffman's legislation, Senate Bill 289, Home Energy Conservation. Senator Hoffman, we had the presentation last time. I asked members to think about the legislation. This is the authorizing legislation for the funding that was contained in the supplemental appropriation,
yes.
Correct? Do you have any comments before we...
I don't have any other comments, but if there are additional comments by the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation, they might have additional comments at this time.
Okay. Mr. Fauske or Mr. Butcher, shaking their heads no? Okay. They were fully supportive and, in fact, enthusiastic at the last hearing about the opportunities this bill and the accompanying funding present. So I'm a big supporter. Is there any discussion? There is no committee substitute to adopt. The bill's in good shape. Any committee discussion? Hearing none, I will entertain a motion to move the bill.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Davis? I move that we move Senate Bill number 289 out of, am I given the right number?
Yes.
Yes, 289.
Yeah, 289 out of the committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note.
Okay. The bill has a further referral to the Finance Committee. Is there discussion of the motion to move the bill? Is there any objection to the motion to move the bill? Hearing none, the bill moves on to the next committee of referral. Okay, let's be sure we sign the committee report. Okay, next we move on to Senate Bill 294, Regulatory Commission of Alaska Positions and Salaries. This is a bill that reflects the recommendations of the task force that was chaired by Senator Liesl McGuire. Mr. Owen, are you going to begin, and then I believe Senator McGuire may join us as well. Mr. Owen, just state your name for the record and your position, and go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Dana Owen. I'm a staff to Senator Ellis and to this committee. Senate Bill number 294 is a result of the work of the RCA task force, which came into being in the last session of this legislature. Their recommendations are several. Two of those recommendations were singled out for this bill because they had broad support amongst the task force. Other recommendations did not have compellingly broad support, so we bring this forward to you for that reason. We have in sections 1, 2, and 3 of the bill, you'll see that what that section accomplishes is to stipulate that a new executive director will be part of the exempt service, and it also moves the administrative law judges also into the exempt service from the partially exempt service.
Okay. Mr. Owen, if you could hold on just a moment, I'd like to note for the record that Senator Bundy has joined us. Go ahead.
And the remainder of the bill has to do with the executive possession, executive director position. It authorizes the, I take it back. There's a section of the bill, section number three, which is, which changes the pay range for, or the pay levels for commissioners from a step C, range 26, to step F, range 30. And the remainder of the bill authorizes the commission to employ an executive director in an administrative position.
Okay. Any questions for the staff presenting the bill? Yeah, we just sort of as a ministerial function took the recommendations of the RCA task force chaired by Senator McGuire and put those into bill form.
Mr. Chairman, I'd also note that there are members of the RCA who wish to testify on the bill this afternoon. There may be a slight delay because they are in a meeting, but I'm hopeful that they will be online momentarily.
Okay. And I would note this is the just the initial presentation of the bill. The bill would, you know, is being heard today and will be held over for further consideration. Is Senator McGuire easily gettable?
I can certainly.
Okay. Could you do that for us? Budget closeout? Okay. Okay, so they're available now? Okay. So we're going to go, staff is going to check on Senator McGuire's availability.
Unmuted.
During this public hearing. We do have Tony Price and Rich Fazaway from the Regulatory Commission of Alaska online at this time, available to answer questions. So, Mr. Price, this is Johnny Ellison, Juno, and my question then to you is, what's the commission or your personal opinion of the legislation that's before us today?
I support the legislation with a couple of changes. One being, there's some confusion in the bill as to who employs the administrative law judges, and we didn't know if the commission or the executive director employed them.
Okay. Mr. Price, could you just state your name and your title for the record and then go forward?
Yes, it's Tony Price, chairman of the Regulatory Commission of Alaska.
Thank you.
And we'll provide that language to you. It's section 4, AS 4205050A, and we propose to add language there that reads, after it says the commission shall employ an executive director, following that, the language added is, and may employ administrative law judges.
And okay.
Following that, further down the bill, after the executive director may employ engineers, hearing examiners, arbitrators, mediators, experts, clerks, accountants, and other agents and assistants considered necessary, period, we propose or ask that you consider adding this language: the executive director shall not participate in the adjudication of any matter to come before the commission. That addresses some issues that arose in past commissions. And our final recommendations are to first 4205254A, and that statute section sets our RCC cap. In all the legislation that's gone before, including our budget, we've talked about the need to increase our RCC cap so that we can generate the revenues to cover our budget. It is presently 0.7%. We propose that you increase that to 0.9%. I would add that people have said we don't want to increase your budget. I said the budget is the budget. This just allows me to collect the revenue to feed it. I don't think 0.9% will be, I don't think we'll be at the cap, but not knowing what next year's revenues will be, it is a dicey thing to try and compute this without a little bit of leeway. And if, in fact, we over-collect, it just rolls forward to the next year, the revenues do, and offsets the next year's collection, so they would be reduced by the underspent. Following that, in 4206-286A, There is also the provision for an RCC cap, and we also ask that you consider changing that to 0.9% from 0.7% for the same reason.
Okay, was that your list, Commissioner Price?
Yes, it was. That's
okay.
All. Thank you.
And our we've been trying to take notes here, our committee staff, and we're trying to accomplish a lot today, so we may not have gotten it all down in writing. Could you and your staff please provide us those suggestions?
We certainly were, Chairman.
In writing. Great. That would be very helpful. The session is adjournment is rapidly approaching, and we're trying to accomplish as many positive things as we can, and your assistance with the technical details would be appreciated.
Yes, sir. We'll provide that following the hearing.
Okay. Questions or comments for Mr. Price? Commissioner Price, Senator McGuire may join us here in a few moments, and I think she was probably going to give us the perspective of the task force in terms of the overall needs of the RCA and the situation there, the underfunding, the understaffing, the inability to attract and retain certain specialized skill sets among your employees. But she's busy with another important task today. So could I ask you, I mean, you've given us your recommended changes, and we will definitely consider those during markup of the bill. But could I ask you to just back up a little bit and just give us a brief overview of why this should be compelling legislation for us in the limited time we have, and what the situation is there and why you need this assistance?
I'll try to give you very briefly, Chairman, the information in the committee. However, I'll just note that our presentation to the task force was 86 minutes, but I'll give it briefly to you. At the level of staffing, we have right now, I think, three engineer positions. We only have one filled. We need all three positions. At this point in time, we're unable to hire an engineer. We thought we had one here just a couple of weeks ago that agreed to come on. He since notified us that he has changed his mind. Our utility financial analysts need to have very high skill sets regarding accounting and financial review. We have five positions there, and only two of those positions are filled. They are with staff that's been with us, five or more years. They are very good staff. However, we're unable to find any more. Their docket load is oppressive, to say the least. We are in a situation where we have taken staff that were, for instance, assistants to the commissioners, and we have redefined those positions as legal office assistants and such, and put them down in the ALJ section to help move orders out. The commissioners have virtually no support for their positions at this point. But we make very fine file clerks ourselves, so we can do that. But it is a very difficult thing to do with the docket loads here. Complicating all this is last year, we, besides all the other statutory deadlines, there was a bill that imposed a six-month statutory deadline on all things that did not otherwise have a statutory deadline. That has dramatically increased the workload here. As we are just simply, if you look at our dockets, you'll see that we're completing dockets virtually days before the statutory deadline or on the day of, as we move from one to another. So we're in a situation where we do not have the revenues, we do not have the staff. This year's budget helps us to get more budget, so that we can hope to fill those positions. And we're working diligently on that. Alternatively, we'll need to hire consultants to come up, and we have a long list of consultants that work for regulatory authorities in the lower 48, and we will be putting out RFPs. So to the extent that we don't have the employees, we'll certainly be paying consultants at a much greater rate. I don't know where else to go. I'm surprised. I'm sorry. I'm surprised by the question. I shouldn't be, but I am.
Well, thank you, Commissioner. I'm familiar with your situation. I'm supportive of this legislation. Besides just fulfilling the function of introducing as a Senate Labor and Commerce Committee bill the recommendations of the task force, I'm personally convinced that we need to take some action. Though these, and it was important to get this on the record, though you felt like you've testified to the task force, most legislators have not heard that. So you will be asked as we go through the legislative process to reiterate these, your case for the record, to build the case for passage of the bill. So that's the legislative process. I'm sure you're getting more and more familiar with that as we go along. So I appreciate you recapitulating what you've said before, but it's not the first time that you will have to do so.
Thank you, Chairman. I'll take that under good advice.
Okay. No, I'm on your team. I'm trying to help out. But, you know, the concerns that you raise are not unique to the Regulatory Commission of Alaska. I mean, some of the specialized skill sets there are unique in state government, and a lot of consumer interests ride on your good work and your timely decisions. But there are people throughout state government or positions throughout state government that we're having a very hard time recruiting quality people for and retaining folks to provide some very important and specialized state services. So it's an opportunity for you all to establish why the legislature should act on this legislation this year, because the problems of recruiting and retaining good quality employees are problematic throughout state government. Or in many areas of state government, I guess would be fair to say.
Yeah, Chairman, I would say that while I'm not as aware as you are, as you've heard from probably all through state government, I've heard from enough of it to realize that it's a very critical issue.
Yep. Thank you, Commissioner. Rich Gazaway is there to answer questions as well. I should note for the record before we go any further that Senator Stevens joined us a while back. Mr. Gazaway, did you have any comments you wanted to make at this time?
I'm here to respond to questions. I believe Mr. Chairman Price articulated the RCA's position on the bill.
Okay, and very well. Thank you. Any questions or comments for Commissioner Price or for Mr. Gazaway? If not, is there anyone here or online who would like to testify during public hearing on this bill at this time? Any comments or questions, requests for information from committee members? Like I said at the beginning, we will hold this bill over and have a committee substitute with those, with some of those proposed changes before us in the future. Oh, Senator McGuire is here. Senator McGuire, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Hope we didn't pull you out of a closeout, or hopefully that's wrapped up.
We just finished one.
Okay. And Commissioner, we had a presentation from committee staff about the bill. The recommendations of the task force that became this Senate Labor and Commerce bill. We heard from Commissioner Price about the reasons for the suggested changes in the legislation, as well as the case for the increase in staff and pay. But we wanted to give you a chance to speak to the work of the task force.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the Labor and Commerce Committee. We spent time over the interim, and I, as the chair, went down to RCA personally and spoke with the staff, listened to an overview of their workload and the challenges that they face. So I think other than the details that you have in here, I just want to add a little bit of soul to it. You know, the RCA is one of the most important commissions that we have. It deals with highly technical, highly complex matters that affect our constituents, the consumers in the state of Alaska, more than probably any other commission. And yet, they have a great challenge in filling the positions that they have. And I think they've walked you through that. And certainly in the report, you'll see the specific vacancies that are there. And really, I think it's divided into two categories: the staff problem with recruitment to fill those vacancies, as well as retention of the highly skilled labor that they need to deal with these complex issues. And then you've got the matter of the commissioners themselves. And, you know, there are examples that we could point to for deputy commissioners in agencies where you wouldn't want to say that one duty is more important than the other, but certainly being an RCA commissioner, effectively acting as a Supreme Court judge. I mean, that's a comparison that I put in my mind instantly, because you're presiding over, as an example, the TAPS tariff case, affecting billions of dollars to consumers and to producers, and you're at that lower level salary, really, when you look at the marketplace. Examples of the commissioners have been given, but you want folks with Juris Doctorate degrees, CPAs, business backgrounds, experience in the private sector, and those are the kind of individuals that are going to be pulled on from the private sector. And so I think we want to be sure that the salary there is competitive, and I don't believe it is right now. Another point I want to make with respect to highlighting the report is the need for what I believe is an executive director or a manager, if you will. What happens currently on the RCA, as it's probably been explained, is one of the five commissioners will serve as chair, but as part of their duties in being chair, they essentially have this administrative function of hiring and firing and all the, you know, the rudimentary business part of the commission.
And managing partner. So
yes, it's like a bit like the managing partner idea. And so what we really sort of do is put a timeout on one of our five commissioners. And so I think that's a really simple thing that could be done right off the bat to relieve some of that administrative burden. So I just wanted to add a little bit of soul to it that everybody asks for raises. There's never enough money. There's never enough space to fill these vacancies. But in this particular case, I am very compelled, and I was very disturbed, actually, as a lawmaker, to see the complexity, the volumes of rate cases and so on that they're dealing with, and to know that there are these vacancies. In one case, there's a young man in one of these departments that he's running it all by himself, and he is just an incredible contribution to our state, but only 2 years on the job and running the whole department by himself, extremely complex, billions of dollars, again, effect on consumers. So I just really encourage this committee to consider moving this forward and raising the salaries up for the staff and the commissioners and making some changes there.
Senator, thank you for your service as chair of the task force. Just a personal comment from me. I support the entire package that's represented in the legislation. And I know I've had some conversations with several people who have said that the staff vacancy issue is the most compelling issue. It is to me, though I support the entire package, the raises for the commissioners. I do consider the commissioner positions necessary to pay a decent wage to get quality people and have those folks. But I also do consider it a form of public service as well. So I'm willing to support a package that increases their salaries, though that's not the biggest motivator for me. The staff vacancies and the staff pay is the most important thing. So I would hope that as the bill goes along, the whole can hang together. But if it hits turbulence or troubled waters, that at least the staff considerations, my personal hope is that the staff considerations would be paramount, that it can all hang together. But if we get into some big fight about commissioner salaries and other folks in the administration and what's fair and balance between other, high-level people in the administration, that wouldn't hang up the entire package. So I hope it can all hang together because it's all justified in my mind, and we're trying to establish that for the record here today. But the staff vacancies, the staff pay is what's most important to me, and I hope that gets all the way through the process. The whole thing, but at least that this year. So I'm hoping that we can move this forward expeditiously. So.
Yeah. Well, just the last thing, I want to thank all the people at RCA for the work they do, and it is public service. But they are the folks that are looking out for the consumers. Mm-hmm. You know, they're looking out for our best interests, and these are the matters of utilities, the things that we have to live. Your basic heating, your basic electrical needs, all those kinds of things. And so when you're kind of looking at the pyramid, this is the needs of Alaskans. And these are the folks that stand there between the private sector and the consumer and fight for those rates and try to make sure they're reasonable and fair and, you know, that we have a process that's defensible. So, yeah.
Well, we all have something to hang our hat on here. If we're for consumer interests or we want to see business move forward and get the deals and rates they need to make a profit and move forward and provide services, it just all fits together. And I would hope we could come together to accomplish this year. So thank you for your service.
Thank you.
Any comments or questions, requests for information before we hold the bill over? If not, Senate Bill 294 is held over at this time, and we move on to Senate Bill 297. non-union public employee salary and benefits. This is a governor's bill, and Commissioner Kreitzer, along with her deputy and other folks, are here today. Commissioner, please come forward. Good afternoon. It's good to see you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Annette Kreitzer. I am Commissioner for the Department of Administration. What I'd like to do is offer some general comments, sort of tailing on to what you were just talking about in terms of recruitment and retention, and then Kevin Brooks is going to step through the bill and just explain what's in the bill. But I just wanted to talk about the fact that the state has the same challenges as many other employers, and the governor, as a responsible, forward-looking CEO, has tasked the executive working group created under Administrative Order 237 to review the issue of recruitment and retention. And as a reminder, that report is available on our department webpage. I'll say that labor negotiations are one part of addressing recruitment and retention, but those decisions are made at the bargaining table. The contract offered to each union so far, and we've made offers to seven unions and have agreements with four, these contracts are the best in 15 years. Changes in compensation for state employees not covered by a bargaining agreement must be accomplished through legislation. That's what we're doing here with Senate Bill 297. And as I said, Kevin Brooks is going to step through that with you. Each union contract is unique. There are other elements of pay in addition to COLA or service steps contained in each contract. And my job is to look at the final full effect of the monetary components of each contract and consider the fiscal impact on the state. I don't know about other departments, but when we close out with Senate Finance today, our proposed budget will be reduced. The criticism that in this bill are service steps not offered to one particular union, in my opinion, is disingenuous, because one of the five offers I made to that union included service steps in addition to a 40-hour work week. I'm addressing some criticism that you're probably going to hear in public testimony when I've finished my testimony, so I just want to address it now as you consider the bill. But I think the changes in the offers that I've made will help the state retain the professional, knowledgeable state employees. As I said, each negotiation is different. You can't simply pick out one element of an offer that a union refused and say, well, you can't offer that to anyone else because we turned it down. The estimate of the cost of the service steps that we offer to the SU, and I bring up that union today because there's a full-page ad running in the Juneau Empire today on this topic. The estimate of the cost of those service steps to that union was $1.9 million for FY09. To me, that's still a big number. So is the $8.5 billion unfunded liability for state employee and retiree pensions and health benefits. So, Mr. Chairman, I just want to set the stage for dealing with this pay bill by saying that we're all dealing with the same issues. We're trying to build a bridge to a gas line. The governor and legislature are struggling with the great needs in Alaska and with production declining at a rate of 6% a year and no offset in additional oil production. We are cognizant in my department of the governor's and the legislative finance committee's caution to hold down spending, but yet we are trying to do sustainable contracts. And so because the controversy that's arisen with one union, I wanted to address that personally with this committee as you hear this pay bill and you hear some of that criticism. And if you're ready for Deputy Commissioner Brooks, he'll step through sections of the bill, or I can answer questions.
Sure, let's have comments and questions, and then we'll have Kevin come up. Senator Bundy.
Thank you. Excuse me, Mr. Chairman. This is a little bit off this bill, but it was you mentioned your negotiations with various unions.
Right.
And recently we passed a supplemental bill that included a substantial amount of money for these negotiations, and I'm just wondering what impact that had on your negotiations, that were sort of pre-funding your negotiations.
Well, through the chair, Senator Bundy, we have concluded negotiations with GGU, and that is in the supplemental, and with the supervisory unit. But the supervisory unit has ballots out now as to whether or not they accept that offer. And the closing time for that vote is tomorrow.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Bundy. Any other questions or comments? If not, Commissioner, thank you for being here. Mr. Brooks, come on up. And then we have we do have folks online to testify as well. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Kevin Brooks, Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Administration. I thought I'd walk you through the bill. It's about a six-page bill. Some parts are pretty straightforward, and others are a little bit more complex. So the bill basically restates salary schedules. It also identifies a number of positions that are specifically set in statute, and we're adjusting those. It runs in the order in which they occur in statute. So with that introduction, I would start on Section 1. It amends Title 16, which is the statutes for the Limited Entry Commission. And those commissioners are set, their pay is set in statute at a range 26, Step C. And what the bill proposes to do is to raise their step to range 27 without any reference to a step. Section 2 of the bill is conforming legislation or conforming language that addresses the Alaska State Defense Force. And because that particular statute in Title 26 refers to the pay statutes in Title 39, this is just conforming language. Section 3 of the bill raises the range for the chief procurement officer from a range 24 to a range 27. There's Senator Elton has a bill in SB 177 that would accomplish the same thing. This position is serves as in all practical purposes as a director of the Division of General Services within the Department of Administration. Several years ago, the director position was deleted, and the duties were shared out or split out among remaining staff, with the primary responsibility for the division residing with the CPO, the Chief Procurement Officer. So this would raise that position to a director level and pay him for the work that has been done over probably the last 5 years is when that position, the previous director position was removed. Section 4 of the bill addresses pay or there's a step limitation for deputy commissioners of the state departments upon appointment. The current language reads that they're appointed at a step not less than step A or more than step F, and so the language just deletes that reference to steps. It's limiting when people are coming from the private sector or promoting from other positions. Section 5 of the bill actually restates the salary schedule contained in Title 39 to reflect a 5.5% increase. Section 6 of the bill, as well as Section 7, provide prospective language that would raise the salary schedule by 3%. Effective July 1 of 2008, and again 3% in July 1 of 2009. Section 8 of the bill adds a new subsection and provides this. This is a section that was the Commissioner Kreitzer referred to, but it adds a section that allows for pay increments every 2 years beyond the step F. Currently, in the way the salary schedule is laid out, an individual would progress from steps A through F on annual increments. And after that, there's a construct in the what's currently section 3927022, which provides for years between steps. This would and the years vary, but this would provide for steps beyond F after every 2 years. And as we looked at this language and checked on the history of it, in 1972, the longevity steps were added to statute. And prior to that, there were steps A through F identified in statute. And at the time, it was determined that we needed additional longevity steps to keep people around. But that was 35 years ago. And now what was viewed at the time as an enticement to keep people and reward them for a longer service has become more of an obstacle for recognizing people that stay in the system for longer periods of time. So it's time to address that outdated structure, and that's what this Section 8 intends to accomplish. It also is tied to an annual review that's basically an acceptable or good review, and somebody who would have that kind of a rating annually would be eligible to receive this step on a two-year cycle.
Question on that point, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Bundy, on that point.
Yeah. Are there people who receive less than good or adequate reviews, and why are they retained?
Through the chair and Senator Bundy, there are individuals that receive, say, low acceptable or unacceptable. There's a process for someone who's unacceptable to not be retained. You can envision cases where someone might have a low acceptable, where you identify areas where a person needs to improve or show better productivity. But in some cases they are not retained, and others you work with an employee if you think you can and try and help them be more productive.
I mean, the majority of reviews good or better than?
I think it's safe to say that a majority of the reviews are probably mid-acceptable or higher. As a practice, I don't have any specific numbers, but I think.
Oh, there's unacceptable, acceptable, and then good?
Again, through the chair, Senator Bundy, it varies, again, depending on the employees, certain, within the bargaining units, we have an evaluation form that has entirely unacceptable or an outstanding, and then within that wide range, there's three levels of acceptable, say low acceptable, mid acceptable, or high acceptable. So conceivably, there's five different rankings that an individual could achieve or attain.
But these are non-bargaining unit members.
That's correct.
So.
But many of them would receive, through the chair, would receive an annual review using a standard form that would be used also for classified folks.
It would be interesting to get further information on how many people are acceptable or better and how many are unacceptable, not by individual, but in categories of numbers of various departments.
Through the chair, Senator Bundy, we could certainly pull some data on that. And one of the things I know that as we talked about the construct of the bill, we felt it was important to tie it to a certain level of performance. And one of the items that the administrative work group that the commissioner referred to talked about was bringing that accountability to the workforce and having not just making it automatic in that continually increasing levels or productivity are recognized with pay adjustments, but the converse would also be true, that you not award them where they're not warranted.
Mr. Chairman,
go ahead.
I didn't want my question to seem that I was opposed to merit pay. I think merit pay is a wonderful idea. My question is aimed at is this just a gimme? Is this a blanket one? Does everybody get?
Commissioner, you want to pull up a chair there so you can get close to the microphone, please?
Sure. Sorry.
To the chair, Senator Bundy, let me just say we're not going to be able to do it all in one year. But we have a governor who believes in accountability, and I know that many members of the legislature have the same point of view, having worked with many of the members over time. And in the working group report that is posted online, it talks about this improvements to the merit system and saying that this recommendation for eliminating longevity steps and using merit steps every other year can't work if there isn't a co-commitment effort to prepare proper evaluations. And so what I'm doing internally with my division of personnel is figuring out how can we make the evaluation process simpler for supervisors so that they will do they'll see the value in it and they'll do the evaluations and it will serve the purpose that it's meant to serve. I'm not going to be able to do that in 1 year or 2 years. It's going to be a longer education process, but that's the goal and that's the intent of the working group.
Okay. Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Commissioner.
I was just
Senator
trying
Bundy?
To avoid the lake woe beyond where everybody's above average.
I get your point.
She's a fan of the Prairie Home Companion. Mr. Brooks, press ahead, and we need to get through this initial presentation.
Okay, I'll step through these as quickly as I can. There are a couple of subsections in Section 8. I've talked about H. Subsection I merely ties this to the pay plan that's in Title 39.25. Subsection J allows for the legislature and independent agencies within the legislative branch to also choose to apply these types of merit increases to their staff or not, by your choice and by the processes that you have for the legislative branch. Section 9 addresses pay for commissioners within the RCA. We heard testimony on the previous bill. This would, again, remove the step designation. They're currently, the RCA commissioners are range 26, step C. This raises them to a 27 without any step designation. Section 10 of the bill repeals the former section 022 that addressed the longevity steps, because now those are contained in the section 011 up above that we just talked about. Section 11 of the bill, and this gets into the uncodified sections of the bill, but this provides that it gets at executive branch employees that are on salary overrides. And one of the things, again, as we talked about this bill, there's a number of employees within the executive branch. You have exempt, partially exempt, and classified. And we've done some work identifying the exempt employees within the executive branch who are currently on a salary override. In other words, they're not being paid off of the salary schedule. They're being paid some amount that's been determined by their employer to be appropriate and adequate. And our goal here is that if somebody has already had their pay adjusted, we're not going to adjust them again by 5.5%. And that's been a policy that that came from the governor and in discussions with her and the chief of staff. It also applies to commissioners. Commissioners' pay was adjusted in 2005 by HB 98, and they would not be receiving, or they're not proposing, we're not proposing that commissioners receive the 5.5% increase or the 3% increase for FY 09.
Okay. Now we understand. Section 12?
Okay. Section 12. Addresses judicial employees. Again, this allows the judicial branch to implement the components of this bill. One thing that we've talked to, and I think you'll hear testimony from the judicial branch, we have inadvertently grouped the magistrates in with the judges, and we would be willing to offer an amendment, and we have some language that could be considered.
Yep.
That would move them to.
We're going to fix that.
Another section.
Keep going.
Section 13 addresses the university and merely states that they are under the policies that are adopted by the Board of Regents and not covered by this bill. And then Section 14 is a prospective application of these steps that we've talked about. So basically what 14 provides for is somebody is a year and a half into a two-year step, that they would keep that same schedule, and they would not be harmed by the bill. And then anybody who's over 2 years, it would be handled different, would be treated differently. But the intent by this language and what that accomplishes is that there'd be no inadvertent harming of any individual.
Okay.
And then 15 again, it's more transition language. Just again, it kind of works together with 14 to make sure that there's not any inadvertent negative impact on an individual who might have otherwise attained that step.
Okay, and the retroactivity?
Retroactivity addresses the first 5.5% increase. It goes back to July 1, 2007. And So that section of the bill has an immediate effective date.
We did it with the oil industry. I guess we can do it with state employees at a high level in the Palin administration. Okay.
Go ahead, Kevin. Just as a wrap-up comment, Mr. Chairman, I appreciate your indulgence, but there has been some I've heard the statement, high-level employees, and you just made that statement yourself. And really what this bill covers is about 1,500 people, and certainly there are 14 commissioners
more
and about 75 directors, but there's a lot of rank-and-file folks. There's commission, you know, there's lawyers, there's clerks, there's accountants. There's a lot of non-coverage in here.
Much broader than my statement.
Not just political appointees, as we've heard characterized.
Any wrap-up comments?
That's it, Mr. Chairman. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Why was the bill introduced on March 3rd? You guys have been working on this for a while. It's a big, important subject. We're in a 90-day session. Why introduction on March 3rd? We've scheduled it as quickly as legally, constitutionally allowable in this committee. But why you just didn't have it together before then?
Mr. Chairman, it's something that we have been working on this. We've been working on it since the fall. And we could have offered it earlier. We've been running different scenarios. We've been in active negotiations with several bargaining units, and that certainly does play into it. We as the commissioner mentioned, we have a tentative agreement with SU. We've been in active negotiations with PSEA and the Marine unions, and so they're all pieces of a bigger
But was the specific timing of the introduction of the bill related to any occurrences or timelines within the negotiation with the public employees?
Not specifically.
Nobody's charged that. I'm just curious.
No.
Okay. Senator Bundy.
Thank you. On page 4, line 3 refers to employees of the legislature. Is that legislative staff or that employees of the legislature at a different level?
Through the chair, Senator Bundy, that would be all employees in the legislative branch, including legislative staff, as well as legislative affairs and others as well.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Mr. Brooks, thank you for being with us. We appreciate the run through of the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Let's get through this public testimony. We have another important bill to move on to as well today. Chris Christensen, why don't you come on up for the court system? Jack Kreinheder from the Governor's OMB is available to answer any questions about fiscal notes. So after Mr. Christensen is finished, we're going to go to Chris Schluss or Schlaus in Anchorage online. Good afternoon. Please go ahead as quickly as you can.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Chris Christensen. I'm the Deputy Administrative Director of the Alaska Court System. I'd like to begin by thanking Governor Palin for including a pay raise for the judicial branch employees in this legislation. In the judicial branch, all employees are non-covered. We have the largest group of non-covered employees outside the university. This is the lowest paid branch of government. Approximately 70% of our employees are range 15 or below. Largely because of this, we have a very high turnover rate, which translates into high training costs, a high ratio of supervisors to clerks, and other inefficiencies. Notwithstanding the pay, we have a lot of very hardworking, dedicated employees. Whenever I talk with court clerks, I'm always struck by the fact that so many of them are proud to work at the court system. They believe the work that they do is important and that it makes a difference. With regard to this proposed raise, I should note that over the last 15 years, state employees have received cost of living adjustments much less than the rate of inflation. In real dollar terms, what I pay to my employees, for example, a range 10 is substantially less than what I paid to a range 10 20 years ago. As Mr. Brooks noted, in addition to the cost of living adjustment, the bill proposes to change the scheme of longevity pay. This proposal addresses a very real problem we have of retaining long-term employees. Most people, entry-level employees at the court system are range 8 or range 10. The clerks of court at most of our locations, the highest ranking person at the court might be a range 16. So there's not a lot of upward mobility to get people to stay a long time. We really feel the need to pay them more longevity pay. Now, Mr. Chairman, there are two provisions of this bill that we're not in agreement with. One of them has been touched on by Mr. Brooks. That is the issue of magistrate pay. Magistrates do not have their salary set in statute. They are ordinary state employees and who are on a salary schedule, who get longevity, and I guess the indication has been that they would support that change. The other
get that proposal to us in writing. We'd appreciate it.
Certainly. The other provision of the bill, Mr. Chairman, is the that relating to the retroactive pay for judges. The bill lumps judges together with political appointees in denying the retroactive pay for the current fiscal year. I would respectfully say that this is sort of the view that we have fought for a number of years and which resulted in the legislature finally giving judges a fairly large pay raise several years ago. You'll recall a few facts from that debate. Judges, unlike most other state employees, do not get longevity pay. A normal employee over a course of an 18-year career will have increases equal to 40% of their salary. A judge who's worked for 18 years gets exactly the same pay as a brand new judge. So the judges are uniquely dependent on getting cost of living adjustments from the legislature because they don't have longevity to make up the difference. During the 20-year period prior to the pay raise in 2006, inflation ran about 77%, they got pay raises equal to about 50%. So there was a substantial loss of income. They went from the highest paid state court judges in the country down to the 48th ranked state court judges in the country. Our superior court judges went from having pay equal to federal district court judges to having pay that was $30,000 a year less than federal magistrates who handle misdemeanors. The results of all this were very, very negative. We had judicial positions, for example, out in Bethel that we just couldn't fill because qualified people wouldn't apply. We had much smaller applicant pools. The applicant pools tended to be much younger and less qualified than they'd been in the past. The legislature looked at this and decided there was a problem and they needed to fix it, and you did 2 years ago. Now, I would just note that between the day the judges got that pay raise and the end of the current fiscal year, that two-year period, the inflation rate is going to be between 7 and 8%. Judges will lose roughly 7 to 8% of the amount you thought was a suitable amount 2 years ago. Right now, we have the highest rate of inflation that we've had in 25 years. The 5.5% retro will not actually make up what judges have lost during this two-year period, but it's a pretty good place to start. And I really, Mr. Chairman, do not want to start down the same path that we started down 20 years ago, where judges' pay is gradually chipped away because small COLA adjustments are not made on a regular basis, and you have to make big adjustments every few decades after you've had lots of problems. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Comments or questions? We appreciate you representing the views of the court system, the judicial branch. You are talking to range 10s here, plus some per diem, so we'll keep it all in perspective.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Okay, let's go to Chris Schluss or Chris Schlaus.
Chris, on the bright side, we don't...
Hi, my name is Christine Schluss.
Yeah. Christine.
And Senator Ellis, I sent you a letter via email last evening, which also sets out my position. Just to tell you why I'm here, I'm an attorney in private practice in Anchorage. I formerly was an assistant public defender, and I also formerly was a member of the Teamster Union.
Okay.
So I'm Chris. Very pro-union, but I must say that on this issue, I have to disagree with union people who are going to speak out against this bill because a union contract did not include the longevity steps. And that's here that's why I'd like to talk to you a bit about that specific portion of the bill. I've been an attorney in Anchorage for 30 years. I started as a public defender in the 70s and early 80s. Where salaries were competitive with salaries in private practice. But that is no longer remotely the case. And what is happening now, and I see it with the AGs, whom I frequently litigate against, the DAs, and the public defenders, is that the state is losing the brightest and the best. These folks often come out of law school now with $150,000 to $200,000 in debt. And you get dedicated people who want to go to work for the state in whatever branch it may be, and they start out, but frankly, they just can't even keep up with their debt. There's an assistant district attorney now who's driving a cab at night in order to try and make ends meet. The Public Defender Agency just lost a terrific, well-qualified attorney who has gone to work for as a sales representative for an online legal resource organization because it pays her 2.5 times what her salary was as a public defender. And as a member of this community, I would urge the legislature to recognize that we need that quality of lawyer. We need the lawyers who can make 2.5 times more in private practice to give them some reason, because they do want to stay in public service, to do so. And these longevity steps, while frankly, in my opinion, don't do enough, they certainly do something. And it's a small step in the right direction, which is to recognize that if the state wants an assistant attorney general in court who has the experience and the capability to litigate against other experienced and competent lawyers, the legislature is going to have to recognize and take steps to pay them accordingly. That's what I have to say based on my experience, and I would even if you sometimes think, well, wait a minute, the union didn't get this, so why should we give it to these people? I would urge you to think about what the commissioner just said about the reasons why that the union did turn it down, and they have a collective bargaining unit to protect them. But these other lawyers, who really aren't the highest paid, they are the rank and file of these different agencies, to recognize their worth and to allow those who want to stay and are willing to stay to recognize by giving them the opportunity to at least have small step increases and give them some incentive to stay in their public service.
Chris, thank you very much for your testimony today. We've had you've been before the committee today, and I apologize for mispronouncing your name, but the spelling I received here of your name was completely off. So,
that's okay.
My apologies. No problem. Thank you again for being with us.
Okay, thank you.
Let's move on to Cynthia Strout.
Senator Ellis, Ms.
Yes.
Strout is not here. She had to go to court.
Okay.
So she's a former public defender, and she's not available.
Okay.
She's tied up in court.
Okay. Thank you, Chris. Let's go to the Bethel site for Margot LaChapelle. Ms. LaChapelle?
Yes, I'm here. I am an employee representative for the supervisory unit here in Bethel, Alaska. I'm also a supervisor with the Department of Health and Social Services, the Division of Public Health Nursing. I work and live here in Bethel, Alaska. As you've heard, I'm sure, the SU supervisory unit has been in negotiations with the state. This has been since December of 06. The administration did refuse to include the longevity steps in our final contract offer. It was 4 days after our union put ballots in the mail so we could vote to accept the contract proposal. The administration put forth this bill, the Senate Bill 297, offering a better deal for the political appointees. By doing so, I feel the administration does not indeed value state employees with the supervisory units. I am concerned for the welfare of the state employee. In addition to denying the SU members the longevity steps during negotiations, the administration waited until after ballots went out to publish the governor's recruitment and retention task force report. It echoed all the things we've been saying for the last year at the bargaining table. We can't hire enough qualified people to staff our positions because the pay is too low. We can't have a retirement system any longer, and most of us will be retiring within the next 5 years. So what have they done to solve the problems? They withheld the report after we were finished bargaining, thereby precluding the implementation of any of its recommendations for 3 years. We believe in order to create a fair and equitable resolution, we ask that this bill be amended so that the extra longevity steps for the non-unionized employees of the executive branch are contingent upon the same steps being applied to the unionized employees of the executive branch. I thank you for this time.
Ms. LaChapelle, thank you for being with us today. Is there anyone else here, or anybody else online or anyone here in the room who would like to testify before this bill is held over? Seeing none, any requests for information that people think of, please get those to our committee staff or off to the department for response, and the bill will be held over for further consideration. Thank you all very much for your participation today. Okay, let's move on. Senator French, my apologies. I had a commissioner in the room, and you weren't at the room at that right moment, so I took that bill first. But please join us at the table. Senator Bundy.
Yeah, brief at ease.
Sure. The committee will stand at ease for a brief moment. We're back in order. Senator French, welcome to the committee. Do you have any quick comments? And I understand there's a committee substitute that you or your staff are going to take us through.
I'll withhold comment until the CS is before the committee, Mr. Chairman, if that's all right with you. I'm happy to give you any information you might need, but my comments are directed towards the CS.
Okay. There is a proposed CS. The way we operate in this committee is to hear about the committee substitute before I entertain a motion to adopt it.
Fair enough.
We don't adopt it as the item before us for presentations. I've always thought that was a ridiculous time waster. So, Mr. Motoro, are you going to walk us through the CS?
You're going to walk us through the CS.
Senator
here,
French.
I'm just here to speak about that, and so if you're ready, I'm ready, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, please go right ahead.
The CS I'll be speaking to is /T-TANGO. That should be the document you have in front of you. And that CS makes six changes, some of them small, some of them fairly significant. And let me just go through them in the order in which you would find them in the bill if you read it from front to back. The first change is on page 3, lines 15 to 17, and essentially this change broadens the viewpoints that are represented on the health care board. We've heard concerns from insurers that the definition of the entities that would make up the insurance representatives on the board was too narrow. And in response to those concerns, we've broken out those two representatives more specifically into sort of a large scale seller and a small scale seller, a retailer, if you will, and a wholesaler. The language is a little bit confusing because the retailer is called an insurance producer. That's a term of art in the industry that refers to the sort of the customer-oriented, on-the-ground insurance retailer. And so what you'll see on lines 15 through 17 of page 3 is the breaking out of those two insurance positions on the healthcare board. The numbers kept the same, but we've instead assigned one to a small-scale retailer and one to a large-scale wholesaler to make certain that you have broader representation. You don't get two wholesalers, if you will, on the board or two retailers. You've got one of each. And that was, as I say, in response to concerns brought to us by underwriters and other insurance industry representatives. The second change is on page 5, lines 6 through 8. And that change has to do with making the health care plan clearly giving a duty to the board, if you will, to make certain and available a plan that can effectively protect an individual from severe financial hardship in times of medical need, taking into account, of course, a household's income and other relevant financial criteria. It'll make certain that insurance is meaningful for each Alaskan, since a $10,000 deductible health care plan isn't much use to a household that earns $15,000 a year. So that's the idea behind that subsection 11 that you see on page 5, lines 6 through 8. The third change has to do with the questions that Senator Stevens brought up during the last hearing, and you should also have in your packet a letter that we've written to you and to be distributed to other members of the committee on that topic. And what the change does is removes a few words from what was sub 7 on page 6. The language did say that the IHS benefits had to meet or exceed the benefits for essential health care services as defined in the legislation. That's been removed to make it clear that individuals who are satisfied with the care they receive through IHS facilities won't be subject to the requirement to have additional coverage. even if the IHS benefits don't line up exactly with essential health care services. It, to a large extent, alleviates the sort of fine decisions that the board would have to make as to each IHS recipient and whether the benefits they received met or exceeded those adopted by the plan. It also, and if the committee would like more in-depth information about that, the letter sort of lays out how the IHS system works. It's fairly complex. I know my staffer and I spent at least an hour on a conference call with folks from who are involved in tribal health. I know we've been in contact with Senator Stevens' office in Washington, D.C. to make certain that our understanding comported with their office's understanding. And I think the probably the important fact, there's two important facts to keep in mind as you look at the interplay between SB 160 and the IHS system. The first is this. Any third-party payer, any private insurance payer, is going to come first in line. If an IHS beneficiary walks into a clinic anywhere, if they have third-party insurance, if they have Aetna, Premera, VA benefits, whatever that is, that's going to be first in line. That's going to pay first. The second thing to keep in mind is that the amount of money dedicated by the federal government to IHS beneficiaries is fixed every year. It's not limitless. So it's not as if we would ever back out federal dollars, because those federal dollars are distributed at the beginning of the year, and that's the end of them. And so there is, in essence, a rationing that takes place in the IHS system. They have enough money for day-to-day clinic visits and taking care of people's checkups and so forth, but when it comes to bone marrow transplants or a knee replacement or a heart surgery, you may find yourself in the position of having been rationed out because the amount of money allocated that year has been used up. So in essence, SB 160 helps add to the health care of any IHS beneficiary in the state, since what they receive, if you read the letter, you'll see that what they receive on average is about $2,000 per individual in benefits, if you spread that across the entire population, whereas someone outside the IHS system receives about $4,000 to $5,000. So the essential changes to make it still allows any IHS beneficiary to join the plan if they choose, or they cannot join the plan depending on how satisfied they are with their own personal situation. And SB 160 will not back out a single federal dollar that's currently being received in Alaska for the benefit of IHS beneficiaries. So that's probably the most complex change that we made, even though it's just a reduction of a few words. The fourth change is on page 6, lines 11 to 14, Mr. Chairman, and that has to do with concerns we've received, probably 20 or 30 emails, passionately advocated emails on behalf of folks from the Christian Science Religion who eschew modern religious or modern medical practices. And so what we've allowed is an exemption for those individuals if they can demonstrate to the board that their deeply held religious beliefs are contrary to this program. They don't have to participate.
Conscientious medical objectors?
Yes, CMOs.
CMOs? Better than HMOs.
Probably better, at least from a financial perspective, Mr. Chairman. But my expectation that those exemptions would be fairly rigorously granted and not liberally. The next change is one that maybe most pertains to the work of this committee, and that is on how we define employees and the employer levy. We did two big things in this change, and that's again on page lines 11 through 20. As we discussed what an employee was, it occurred to us and occurred to through the conversations we've had with you and other members of the committee that we were defining employee too broadly. You can, and here's the thought experiment that helps you understand why we went the way we did. You can imagine a business that employed nothing but military spouses, or the spouses of state employees, or federal employees, and all those individuals are covered by health insurance. They might have 5, 10, 15, 20 employees that all have health insurance through their spouses. There's absolutely no need to apply an employer levy against that employer because not a single one of those individuals needs health insurance. So we've defined an employee as someone who someone who's required to participate in the Alaska Healthcare Plan, and that means they don't have coverage anywhere else. So it's more than just an employee, it's an employee who doesn't have access to any other medical insurance. That's change number one. Change number two is instead of counting the number of employees, because you get into problems of defining what that is, how many hours a week is an employee? Is it 10, is it 20, is it 30? We just went with a payroll number, which is roughly equal to what we would imagine 10 full-time employee equivalents is, and that's the $500,000 figure. If your total payroll of employees that don't have coverage anywhere else is $500,000 or less, no levy whatsoever. If it's between 500,000 and a million, then it's 1%. If it's over a million, it's 2%. And so we think that's more business friendly. We think it's easier to understand, and we think it compensates or takes into account the fact that many people get health insurance coverage from their spouses. Finally, the bill on the last page, page 12, line 18, makes some changes to the effective dates to comport with concerns that the alleged legal had regarding the implementation difficulty relating to the adoption of regulations. And so we acceded to their requests and made a change to the effective dates. Those are the changes, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Senator French, for going through the proposed CS. I appreciate the refinements in the bill and addressing some of the labor and commerce issues involved in the legislation. Are there any comments or questions for the presenter? We have a couple of folks who have signed up to testify. I don't believe the proposed committee substitute is out there around the state at this stage, though we'll attempt to get it out there. So I'm not sure if people are testifying on that or just on the issue generally, but they're just two folks, so I want to hear from them now. First is Mary Raymond from Homer.
Yes, this is Mary Raymond, and after 28 years of listening to Health Task Force and the various bills trying to get affordable insurance, this is very exciting. So my concern was that it was promoted as compulsory, and I see that most of those of my concerns about that have been addressed within the bill, so that people who cannot afford it, that things have been taken care of so that it will be covered. So that's about all I have to say, except that I've been listening to some discussion of House Bill 407 with lots of concerns and with the idea of taking 5 years to implement it. That's much too long, and we have studied this and worked on it. There's information available. We should be able to proceed with a plan. So thank you, Senator French, and all the rest of you who work on it.
Okay. Ms. Raymond, thank you for your time today. Let's move on to Delta Junction for Patrick Dalton.
Thank you, Senator French. First of all, I agree with the public oversight in line five. I think that's a great thing. I don't know how much of a private market there would be in this. I also think that on the health care board that you need two alternative health professionals over.
Mr. Dalton?
Yes?
You were cutting out there. You need to, I don't know if you touched the mute button, or could you just start over again, please?
Yes, sir. I agree with the public oversight on line five of the bill. I think that's important. Now, I don't know how you can get a private, the private market system. That's what I believe in, and I think that's great. I'd like to suggest on the health care board, you need two alternative health care professionals, say naturopath or herbologist. However, I would allege to you that you have no constitutional authority to require a citizen to contract into any health care plan whatsoever, except possibly your constitutional authority to legislate laws. Secondly, there exists a hypocrisy since you require everyone to have a health care card, and then you turn around and deny coverage to any Alaskan that does not have a card. Now, in the preamble to your bill, you've clearly stated that all Alaskans are eligible for this. Why not simply expand health care coverage to any Alaskan that proves they're a citizen or a resident, and that'll take care of all the rest, and that way you don't have to force compliance by people? And furthermore, what kind of criminal penalties are there for not partaking in this system? And finally, if you are going to have an opt-out, if you feel you have to, do have to require mandatory health care coverage, which I have alleged to you you don't have the right to do, if you do, I would suggest that you have an opt-out like the gentleman before me or two people before was mentioning. You have an opt-out system. However, I heard him state that if they can demonstrate they have a firmly held religious belief against the system. Now, how can you demonstrate, how can one demonstrate they have a firmly held religious belief? That's an objective truth, but a religiously held belief is a subjective matter. There's no way of you objectively determining whether someone has a firmly held religious belief. And thank you for considering my input here. Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Dalton, thank you for sharing your thoughts. Folks, we're taking notes, and we will think about your suggestions. Is there anyone else here who would like to participate in this public hearing on the legislation? Senator French, anything in wrap-up? The plan is to hold this bill over until Thursday's committee hearing, when we will have a quorum and the requisite number of votes to adopt the committee substitute and to move the bill along. I think we're nearing the end of our work in this committee on this bill. Any requests for information or anything else, please direct those through the committee staff. I would like to make an announcement. Well, let me go ahead and hold the bill over for further consideration at this time. Thank you both for being here. Just an announcement that the committee, Senate Labor and Commerce, will meet this Saturday here in the Belch Room from 4 o'clock until 5:30 in the afternoon. I know that may be a bit of an inconvenient time for members, but we're hoping we can have folks here to catch up on the work before us in a 90-day session. And that was the only time that members and rooms and schedules allow us to have a meeting. Is there any further business to come before us at this time? Seeing none, we are adjourned at 3:10 in the afternoon.